From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Senate Armed Services Committee is holding hearings on gays in the military. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Alan Berube about the history of gays and lesbians in the military and the regulations that have banned them. Berube is the author of Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. Also today, Just Another Girl on the IRT. It's a new feature film about a young African-American woman in Brooklyn. We'll meet the writer-director, Leslie Harris. She says she's tired of movies that are only about the boys in the hood. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Roseanne Cash's new album, The Wheel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Activists on both sides of the abortion issue say they expect a tough fight on Capitol Hill over President Clinton's pledge to lift a 16-year ban on federally funded abortions. NPR's Pas Cohen reports.
When the president's budget request goes to Congress next week, White House officials said today it will not include the so-called Hyde Amendment, which prohibits use of Medicaid funds for abortion unless the pregnant woman's life is endangered. The amendment has been part of every appropriations request for the Department of Health and Human Services since Republican Congressman Henry Hyde of Illinois won its passage in 1976. Congressman Hyde and other anti-abortion activists say they're not sure they can win, but they'll do what they can to restore the ban. And they say that'll include trying to convince Congress that Medicaid-funded abortions are an expensive tax and pocketbook issue as well as a moral one. Abortion rights advocates also predict an uphill congressional battle for their side, but they say they hope the change in the White House means the beginning of the end of anti-abortion victories. In Washington, I'm Pas Cohen.
Israel sealed off the occupied West Bank today after gunmen shot and killed two Israeli traffic police. The order keeps 1 million Palestinians from entering Israel. Police charged that today's murders were the work of Palestinian militants. So far this month, 13 Israelis and 26 Palestinians have died in violence. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin went on national television today to announce the closure of the West Bank and to say that he's ordered the reinforcement of army units in the occupied territories. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that the United States is trying to strengthen economic sanctions against Libya, which has refused to turn over two suspects wanted in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In an effort to force Libya to turn over the suspects, the United Nations imposed limited sanctions last year, cutting off air links to Libya and banning arms sales. But the country was allowed to continue selling oil, its principal export. The limited sanctions have not had the desired effect, and Secretary Christopher told the Senate Foreign Operations Subcommittee today he is very frustrated by the situation.
I think the time has come to stiffen the embargo against Libya. We're consulting with our allies now about ways to stiffen it. One of the things we want to talk about is an oil embargo.
It remains to be seen whether the Security Council will approve a Libyan oil embargo now, having refused to do so in the past. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 2 points to close at 3,457. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 230 million shares. This is NPR News. The Clinton administration had strong support today for legislation aimed at keeping companies from hiring new workers to replace strikers. Labor Secretary Robert Reich compared the practice of hiring permanent replacement workers to management aiming a loaded gun at employees. The so-called strikebreaker bill is now before labor subcommittees in the House and Senate. It's opposed by many businesses and most Republicans in Congress on the grounds that it would give labor an unfair advantage in contract disputes. Sources say New York City's former chief judge, Saul Wachtler, will plead guilty tomorrow to sending threatening letters to a former lover. Under a deal reached today, Wachtler is expected to spend some time in jail. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Wachler was arrested last November and accused of waging a lengthy harassment campaign against Joy Silverman and her teenage daughter. Silverman is a prominent socialite and Republican fundraiser. At one time, the couple had been romantically involved. The arrest and subsequent indictment of Wachler cut short the career of one of the most influential judges in the country. Wachler had reportedly planned to plead not guilty by reason of insanity, but a source close to the investigation today confirmed that Wachler has decided to plead guilty to one felony charge in connection with the case. He will do so at a hearing in Trenton, New Jersey, tomorrow morning. The charge carries with it a penalty of up to 5 years in jail, but the judge is expected to impose a lighter sentence in exchange for the guilty plea. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Consumer confidence declined in March, apparently because people were uncertain about the economic recovery and insecure about their jobs. The Conference Board, a private research group, reported that its index of consumer confidence dropped 6 points in March. It was falling for the third month in a row. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Senate Armed Services Committee opened hearings on homosexuals in the military. President Clinton supports lifting the military ban on gays and lesbians. He asked the Pentagon to submit its policy recommendations by July 15th. In the interim, gays are still prohibited from serving, but recruits are no longer being asked about their sexual orientation. What is the history of gays and the military? We invited Alan Berube to join us. He's the author of the book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. He started his research in the late 70s. His early research was sponsored by the San Francisco Lesbian and Gay History Project. The military's policy of screening out gays and lesbians dates back to the early 1940s.
The screening started in 1941 amid much controversy. And what it did for the first time was, under a draft, to ask potential inductees if they were homosexual. And on that basis, if they were to say yes, then they would be excluded from military service. Right away, it created a problem, which was that men who were heterosexual began to say they were homosexual to avoid the draft. And two, gay men began to be able to avoid military service by saying they were homosexual.
What was the reason for instituting the ban on gays?
The ban or the screening?
The
ban really has two parts. It's screening and discharge. The screening part was, it was brought in kind of on the backs of the psychiatrists. They were beginning to be involved in the military institution, really for the first time in World War II in any significant way. And their argument was that if we screen recruits for psychiatric problems, even those who aren't insane, that was the old arguments that people were either insane or sane, they were saying that they were personality disorders, too, that would might lead people to break down in combat. If we can identify them at the entry level, then we can avoid psychiatric casualties in the military. That was a promise they couldn't keep. They realized by the middle of the war that you can't screen out people who are going to not do well in military service. But they were trying to do that. And in that was the category of a constitutional psychopathic state, subcategory sexual psychopath, subcategory homosexual. And that's how the screening for homosexuality began, as a subcategory of psychopath.
So homosexuals were considered psychopaths, and the fear was that they wouldn't perform well under the pressure of war?
Right. Screening was based on three reasons. One is that homosexuals were considered to be unfit because gay men, queers as they were called, were effeminate. It was based on a stereotype that all queers were fairies and therefore would not make good soldiers, a wrong stereotype. The second was that they were mentally ill, they were emotionally unstable like women, and since women couldn't perform in military, then gay men couldn't perform. And third is that they would be teased and abused by the other men when they found out that they were fairies, and that they would break under that pressure, not necessarily combat, but under being teased, and the sexual attraction might disrupt morale. Those were the initial three reasons.
So,
the security risk reason wasn't introduced until the Cold War, and it was rejected, in fact, during World War II as a legitimate argument against gays serving.
The regulation that screened out gays was instituted before World War II. Did that change when the war started?
Yes. In fact, under the pressure of war, when there was an increasing manpower and, by the middle of the war, woman power shortage, the screening standards became more and more lax, so that, in fact, for women in the Women's Army Corps, they were not screened, specifically screened for homosexuality, for lesbianism, until very late in the war when the recruiting was over. And in many, many induction stations, men were knowingly taken in as gay. The induction examiners were wise to the fact that many men were trying to avoid military service by saying they were gay, so they just wouldn't believe them. What's interesting about the current debate in relation to World War II is that the main focus in World War II was the duty of the citizen to serve his country. And now the focus, the debate, is about whether military service is a right or a privilege.
So the military was more open to accepting homosexuals during the height of the war. Is that what you're saying?
Not officially, but in practice, yes. During the pressure, the manpower needs, the shortages of wartime, they were much more kind of practical and even cynical about keeping homosexuals in until the war was over.
Have there been periods in which the military has been particularly vigilant in trying to ferret out homosexuals who have passed and have gotten in?
Absolutely. And one of the problems that the policy creates, this is important, this is what the policy creates, is a climate of fear, rumor spreading, and witch hunting, as it was called as early as World War II, where someone could turn in the name of someone and saying they're a homosexual, and then investigations would start. These would erupt and still erupt all over the place. They are one of the, in a way, uncontrollable consequences of the policy. They lead to people submitting lists of names, people being interrogated, psychologically abused, and even physically tortured for hours and hours, sometimes days without end, until they provide names of people they know to be gay or sign a confession that they have committed sexual acts. That leads to a whole other set of names. People get called in. The history is one of locking up groups of people in what were called queer stockades, queer brigs, parading them and displaying them in public for public humiliation by marching them in segregated units in front of the other troops so they would be jeered at and catcalled, eating separately in mess halls, even putting in barbed wire pens with signs that say queer stockades. Then they were sent home and forced to turn themselves in at their draft boards, where their hometown, they would be basically be outed in their hometowns. The whole process of discharge under those circumstances, and when there are roundups or purges or witch hunts, is a shameful history in our country. It has involved tens of thousands of people. It has, for the most part, been secret. It is a history of abuse and violence and cruelty. It involves suicides and even murders in some cases. And there's an illusion being created that this policy is merely a bureaucratic procedure. It just has to do with legalistic procedures, and that no people are affected by it. But the history is something completely different than that.
My guest is Alan Berube, author of the book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Berube. One of the arguments being used now against admitting gays to the military is that it could be a threat to discipline and morale.
That's right.
Is that a new argument?
No, that's not a new argument. That was the third argument that I'd mentioned from World War II. The other two, the effeminacy and the mental illness arguments, have been dismissed. But the third one still exists, and in a way, that is at the core of the policy. It kind of has two parts. One has to do with prejudice, and one has to do with sexuality. But that is the core argument, I think, against for the exclusion of homosexuals in the armed forces.
Can you expand the argument for us and explain the premise of it?
The morale and discipline argument. Actually, one thing that's important is that the phrase morale and discipline is a buzzword, and it covers up a whole conglomeration of prejudices, fears, sexual tensions, hatreds, disgust, urges to kill. I mean, there's an ugly core there. But the buzzword is morale and discipline. Two parts of it have to do with prejudice and with sex. The prejudice part is similar to the arguments against African Americans, for example. Then it was white men just will not serve with Negroes, as the language was in the 40s. Now it's that heterosexual men just will not serve with homosexual men or men they know to be homosexual. So that part of the argument is that prejudice, basically the assumptions are that prejudice exists. It will not change. It cannot change. And the unstated assumption is, from the military officials, we don't want it to change. Therefore, heterosexual men cannot trust, will not serve with, nor will they take orders from anyone they know to be homosexual. That's the prejudice part of the argument. The sex part of the argument is that sexual tensions exist within same-sex situations. The shower, this is the famous shower argument, the barracks, closely knit combat units. Sexual tensions exist there because homosexuals exist there. If we get rid of the homosexuals, we will get rid of the sexual tensions.
Well, is there anything historically that argues one side or the other side of this story? For instance, if gays for the first time in recent history were allowed to be in the military and be out,
right,
it would be the first time that men in their troops knew that they were gay or that women around them knew that they were a lesbian. And there would perhaps be a certain sexual tension in the air that hadn't been there before, and a certain discomfort for straight men in the showers or in the barracks.
Right. Well, let's take this up. There's two parts there. Let's take those apart. The first is this would be the first time that anyone who was heterosexual knew they were serving with someone who was bisexual or gay or lesbian. That's false because one of the things that's interesting is how many gay men, for example, and lesbians remember in World War II that they were serving with people who knew they were gay. And what's happened recently on many radio talk shows, for example, is that heterosexual veterans are calling in and say, I knew that I served with so-and-so. It wasn't a problem. They didn't bother me. I didn't bother them.
You could argue, though, that the people who gays and lesbians came out to in the military were the people who were most open-minded about it, not to the people who were most homophobic.
Right, and there's really no reason for that to change. I mean, there's no reason for that to change if the ban were lifted.
In other words, people wouldn't have to be very out. They wouldn't have to proclaim who they were, and it wouldn't have to be an issue unless they wanted to make it one. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Or, I mean, there's another stereotype being constructed here during this debate, which is very interesting, is that the only way anybody knows that someone is gay is when they go to other people and say, I am a homosexual. Well, that could happen, and that happens once in a while. But in fact, there's other ways of people knowing. They see them going to a gay bar. Rumors spread. It's extraordinary how many people who are heterosexual kind of know who is gay around them. When it's on that level, which is going to be still the common level if the ban is lifted, it's not the same as a deliberate coming out, kind of in-your-face coming out statement.
What do you make of the argument that if gays were legally allowed in the military, that there'd be a lot of tension in the showers?
This shower argument is very interesting to me. It has become kind of the symbolic core of this whole debate. And it's about sex. It's about desire, not sex. It's about desire and about knowing. The argument is that heterosexual men since they have to strip down with other men in shower rooms, have a right not to knowingly be in the presence of someone who is homosexual and who might look at their naked bodies with sexual desire. That's when they use the term right to privacy, that's what it's about. It's the right not to be looked at. Two things very interesting about this is that, first of all, there's a kind of female impersonation going on here, that heterosexual men are presenting themselves as women who are feminized, the sexual objects of the men who are the gay men who are looking at them with desire. That's interesting because I don't know of any other place in American society where heterosexual men are saying that they are just like women and that they need the protection of the government from the men who are the gay men. I think the underlying situation here is there's a core contradiction. The military creates environments that where men look at each other men's bodies. Just men look at each other men's bodies, are in close quarters with each other, and it kind of incites an eroticism, no matter who people are, attention, jealousies, romance, buddies, love, a desire to look at each other. That's and the procedures for stripping men down, the physical and induction physical examinations, for example, are classic, where men are walking around naked, being looked at very, very, very closely in all their body parts by other men. That's okay as long as the looking allegedly is not done with sexual desire. The irony is, or the difficulty is, that the eroticism of those situations cannot, the military creates those situations. Homosexuals, in fact, are very good at controlling themselves in those situations. We have a lot of practice doing that. But the removal of homosexuals, all that does is it creates the illusion that there's no eroticism there, because allegedly there are only heterosexuals left. So what you do is allow heterosexuals to believe that only heterosexuals are there by making sure that they don't know that there are any homosexuals there.
In your book, you quote a couple of studies conducted by the military and the Defense Department about the ability of gays to serve well in the military.
Right.
What did those studies find?
The studies began within months of when the policy was put into effect, the discharge policy in 1943. The first one was issued in 45. They remarkably come to very similar conclusions. One is that homosexual soldiers, considering their performance, lesbian and gay soldiers perform no better and no worse than other personnel. Second is that there is no evidence for them being a security risk. Third is that they do not constitute a class of people, and the military has no evidence for saying they constitute a class of people. And fourth, that their performance should be judged on their individual merit and not as members of a class. Almost consistently, most of these reports that have been generated from within the armed forces all the way to up to a couple of years ago have been suppressed by the Army and the Navy and not been allowed to be released. Whenever the military has conducted its internal reports and they have come to these conclusions, it has suppressed these reports and kept them from being made public.
One of the reports that you quoted, a 1957 Navy report that concluded there was no evidence to support the idea that homosexuals as a class cannot acceptably serve in the military or that there were security risks, that 1957 study was released in 1977. So that's been out for a while.
It has been out for a while, and it was released because a judge ordered it to be the Navy to release it. They had first claimed that it didn't exist. When the judge in Chicago, I think, in a discharge trial, appeal trial, subpoenaed the report, then the Navy made it public.
Now, that 1957 report recommended no change in military policy on homosexuality because that report suggested that the military shouldn't move ahead of civilian society in its acceptance of homosexuality.
That's right, and that really echoes with what the many military officials senators, for example, government officials are saying, that the military is not an engine of social change and should not be, and should not lead. It should follow the rest of society. In terms of the political climate, social climate in 1957, It would have been an innovation at that point to have a non-discrimination or to lift the ban in the armed forces. Right now, the U.S. military is one of the few major agencies in the country that still has such an explicit and such a vehemently anti-gay policy. So it is way behind the rest of much of society. Society has changed considerably since 1957.
Your book, Coming Out Under Fire, explores a certain paradox, which is that although gays have been officially unwelcome in the military, many gays have served in the military, and in fact, World War II helped to create the gay subculture in America.
Right, right. There is a continuing irony here, which is that the military unintentionally, and certainly probably doesn't want to be doing this, but what it does is, in fact, especially when there's a draft, take people from small towns and rural areas, collects them into military bases, which are often stationed, located near major metropolitan areas. It is one of the most efficient ways of introducing young men and women to the gay life in the cities. It also created, by targeting homosexuals and by defining them really for the first time, in World War II, as a class of people who are targeted for systematic discrimination, it gave gay men and lesbians and bisexuals their first cause, which was to fight for the right to serve in the military. So in a way, it defined homosexuals as a class of American citizens and then politicized that class by systematically discriminating against them, so that in a way it helped to shape a gay movement.
What do you see now as being the alternatives that the Senate Committee on the Armed Services might come up with now?
I have no idea. I think the Senate Committee, Armed Services Committee, really with Senator Nunn as their chair, is mostly interested in figuring out ways to keep the ban in place, maybe making minor alterations, but using the hearings as a way of establishing the proponents of the ban as the rational, objective middle in this debate, and establishing anyone for lifting the ban as to be an extremist on one side, and anyone who is vehemently anti-gay as the extremist on the other side, so that keeping the status quo with minor modifications, like not asking people as they enter, for example, it looks like their interest is in using the hearings to do that.
How important do you think the ban on gays in the military is in the gay community?
It is very important. And the reason is not so much because the military is such an important institution for many, many people, because for many it's not, although it is critically important for those who are lower middle class, working class, and poor, it being one of the few places that you can get work and training these days. But why it's very important is the same reason why military service has been important for African Americans, for women, for Japanese Americans who were in the internment camps, and other people who had been excluded from the mainstream of public life. And that is, military service, especially the right to serve in combat, whether we like it or not, has traditionally been the justification and the way of earning legitimation and full citizenship in the United States. So this has become a battle over citizenship, over full citizenship. Who is going to be entitled, which Americans are going to be entitled to become and remain full citizens in the United States? So it's highly symbolic. It is the battle over that issue of citizenship.
Ellen Berube, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Ellen Berube is the author of the book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Leslie Harris watched the movies made by some of the brightest young black filmmakers, like Straight Out of Brooklyn and Boys in the Hood, and saw there was something missing. Where were the women in the hood, and what were their stories? So Harris decided to make a movie about a young African-American woman growing up in Brooklyn. Coming up, we talk with Leslie Harris about her first movie, Just Another Girl on the IRT. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Wheel, the new album by Roseanne Cash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The House Armed Services Committee began consideration of President Clinton's defense budget today. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Colin Powell defended the Clinton administration's spending plan. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
Aspin promised that next year's $263 billion defense budget would maintain the quality of American forces. His guiding principle, he said, was to make sure that there would be enough money to equip and train the troops, even if that meant the size of the military would come down. Aspin faced criticism from two sides. Some lawmakers said the president's plan doesn't reduce defense spending enough. Others, including Floyd Spence of South Carolina, the ranking Republican, said the plan goes too far.
Mr. Chairman, I want to, in the very outset, I express my concern for what many feel are cuts that are too deep in our military.
Aspin told lawmakers that no major weapons programs were cut in next year's budget, but he said some changes will come after he completes a full analysis. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
President Clinton has decided he will not use the budget process to raise fees for mining and grazing on government lands in the West, cheering Western senators, but disappointing environmental groups. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Western senators pressured the president to drop the mining and grazing fee increases, claiming they would hurt ranchers and miners and the communities they support. Environmentalists charge the below-market fees amount to subsidies for environmental damage. They failed to get Congress to increase the fees and saw the president's plan to raise them in the budget as a major environmental victory. They're angry with Mr. Clinton for reversing himself, but an Interior Department spokesman says the administration still intends to charge more for mining and grazing on government land. The spokesman says mining royalties will be addressed in legislation, and grazing fee hikes may come out of a process begun by Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, who plans a series of grazing meetings in western states next month. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the U.S. will try to put together an oil embargo against Libya for not turning over suspects in connection with the bombing of a Pan Am plane over Scotland in 1988. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Christopher accused Libya of stalling the investigation of the Pan Am bombing and said that time has passed. At the same time, Christopher called Iran an international outlaw and indirectly criticized France, Germany, and other allies for supporting a World Bank loan to Iran. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 2 points to close at 3,457.27 on volume of more than 230 million shares. This is NPR News. According to the White House, President Clinton wants to end a ban on federally funded abortions for poor women, and both sides are predicting a tough battle in Congress. A White House spokesman says Mr. Clinton will not include the ban when he sends his fiscal 1994 budget to Congress next week. For 16 years now, the ban has been written into the federal budget and bars federally paid Medicaid abortions except when a woman's life is threatened. The amendment is called the Hyde Amendment for its sponsor, Congressman Henry Hyde. The World Health Organization is reporting that the number of cases of skin cancer is increasing around the world. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
According to the WHO, Australia, New Zealand, and some parts of the United States have the highest rates of malignant melanoma, a potentially fatal form of skin cancer. But the rates of skin cancer are climbing in many countries, especially Canada, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. Scotland had the most rapid increase in the rate of skin cancer. Melanoma cases there rose 80% in the last decade. The WHO does not blame a depletion of the ozone layer for the increased cancer cases. Instead, WHO scientists say that sunbathers, especially those with fair skin, fair hair, and blue eyes, haven't gotten the message that too much time in the sun can be dangerous to their health. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor has accused Japan of being a major player in the current gridlock on world trade talks. Cantor says the 6 years of talks being held with a general agreement on tariffs and trade will not be completed if Tokyo continues to behave as if it has little stake in the outcome. His comments were the strongest yet from the new administration, which has criticized Japan recently for closed markets and its distance from the world trade talks. Japanese officials accuse Cantor of not being in touch with reality. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Riding the IRT subway line in New York, Leslie Harris used to watch the teenage girls and wonder what their stories were. She grew up in Cleveland's inner city and knew how rough it was to come of age and make something of yourself. Her new movie, Just Another Girl on the IRT, is the story of a young woman growing up in a Brooklyn housing project. It's Harris's first film, made on the proverbial shoestring, and it won the Special Grand Jury Award at Robert Redford's Sundance Film Festival. Critic Greg Tate wrote, "This movie slices through the meat of easy teen sexploitation to get at the marrow of teenage ignorance, shame, and confusion about contraception, sexually transmitted diseases, abortion rights, and parenting." The main character, Chantel, is played by Arian Johnson. Here she is, standing on the subway station, letting you know she's not just another girl on the IRT.
People today be bugging. The other day I was on the number 2 train with my friend, just bugging out, having a good time. And people just started staring at us like we were some sort of street girls with no future. Yo. When I'm with my friends, I act like it don't matter. Because it don't. But between you and me, pisses me off. When they think they can just judge you by the way you dress? I always get A's and B's in all my classes. I'm the best student in my calc class. People be tripping when they find out how smart I really am.
Just Another Girl on the IRT is one of the first feature films by and about an African-American woman.
Watching films like Straight Outta Brooklyn, hanging with the homeboys, Boys in the Hood. I mean, you hear all the male, there's male in the title, you know, and I wanted to say, well, where are the women? And sometimes I feel that especially African-American women had just been ignored, young women have been ignored, and whereas maybe the African-American males have been getting a bad rap, the women stories, you know, are being pushed in the background, and sometimes that's even worse. So I wanted to show that this is the story of a young woman who's a person who has ambitions and dreams and goals and who's not always perfect. You know, she's a well-rounded character.
Is there anybody in particular who you base the main character, Chantel, on?
Well, actually, a little bit of myself, I think, growing up. I grew up in an urban environment, and, you know, both my parents were together, and they were working hard. But sometimes it was hard for them to spend time with me. I also, I think, based the film on doing research at different organizations that delve into teen sexuality. Also, I used to instruct video at Borough of Manhattan Community College, where I taught the students how to edit videotape. And I would talk to them and, you know, get to know those students. And just getting to know people who live in my neighborhood, young women who would take the train, and just talking to them to find out what their perspective of growing up in the 90s is like.
One of the things Chantel has is attitude. She knows how to talk tough when she needs to. She knows how to be sassy when she needs to. Why is attitude so important?
Well, you know, Chantel, she's 17, and she's grown up in Brooklyn and Brooklyn, New York, and it's a rough in the 90s growing up, I think, there. And she has to learn, know how to kind of like, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk. And it's not all about her specifically, that she wants to feel part of the whole environment, but at the same time, she's a unique individual with dreams and aspirations herself. But, you know, growing up, she's 17. She's a teenager, rebellious, outgoing. This is her character.
The main character, Chantel, gets pregnant and just goes into complete denial, won't admit it to herself or to other people. She even takes the pregnancy test, the home pregnancy test, over and over, thinking, well, maybe the test is wrong. Maybe next time it'll be different. Did you get that from research, or do you know people who went through that kind of denial?
Well, I actually did some research and talked to teens who have went through that. Some of my friends went through that. In a way, I went through that sometimes. And I think that I wanted to show also that Chantel is confronting a problem. Her problem is that she's 17 and she has an unwanted pregnancy. And I think that, the film is also about how human beings confront problems. And we like to think that we are so intelligent that when we face a problem, all the answers are simple and it's kind of cut and dry, and that we will react in a logical way. But I think when you confront a problem in reality, fear sets in and emotions set in. And sometimes that's not as clear cut as logic is. And Chantel is going through denial because this is how she's reacting to the situation. She has a lot to lose now. She's telling her friends she wants to graduate early. She's telling her teachers, her principal, you know, she's going to hang out and, you know, introduce her friends to all the college guys. And now she's faced with this problem that's maybe going to stop her. And she doesn't want to face up to it. So I think it's even adults sometimes don't face up to problems the way we would like us to think we would.
Let's talk about the two teenage boys that you created for the movie, the two young men. And I'm thinking of Chantel's two boyfriends. One is a guy who's from the projects, and you know, he's an okay guy, but he doesn't have any money, and he can't take Chantel to nice places. And the other guy has a Jeep, and he can use his mother's apartment for him and Chantel to be alone together. What did you want from these two characters?
Well, I wanted to show also in the film, Chantel does live in the projects. He lives in an urban environment. But in a lot of communities, and especially African-American communities, you have this like dichotomy of classes. And Chantel grows up in the projects, but Tyrone lives down the street, and he lives in a brownstone. And his mother is a principal, and she's they're from a more upper middle class background. And Chantel is attracted to that. And I wanted to show in the male characters just how actually how sometimes they get dissed by the women, because you don't see male directors usually don't want to tell that side of the story, even though that's pretty common. And how Tyrone, who is the more wealthier of the boyfriend, how he is trying to be all cool and, as the kids say, Mac Daddy and all this. And then you find out that he's afraid and he's trying to confront these issues, too. So with those male characters, I wanted to show that they were human beings also.
Filmmaker Leslie Harris is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Leslie Harris. She wrote and directed the new film, Just Another Girl on the IRT. Your character, Chantel, wants to be a doctor and to get out of the projects. Did you want to be a filmmaker when you were growing up, and did you see that as your ticket out?
Actually, I always loved film, and I would stay up late. My mother loves films, and she loves, like, Betty Davis, old Betty Davis, Joan Crawford movies, Jean Harlow. I would stay up and watch those movies. And then I started to really appreciate some of the foreign films, and There's a university, Case Western Reserve, in Cleveland, and they would have some different types of films. And I started to seek out foreign films and study foreign films in college, and had a scholarship in financial aid and had the opportunity to go to school in France and study some of the really profound filmmakers like, you know, Truffaut and Godard and Renoir, and really loved just filmmaking, period. But I didn't see too many films. You know, I wanted to start seeking out more African-American filmmakers. I started to study Oscar Michaud and films like Gordon Parks, and I really wanted to see something that spoke of my experience and in myself. And then, you know, 5 years ago, I really just got frustrated and said I still hasn't seen any film that I think speaks of a young woman coming of age like I felt.
Did you get to go to film school?
I have my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from Denison University, and there I came in as an art major with painting and drawing, and I started to actually gravitate towards cinema studies and cinema production and film production, and started to make some animated films in college and some shorts. And then after I graduated from the university, I worked in advertising for a while, mm-hmm. and was very unhappy there because, you know, in the morning when you get up and you want to put the covers back over your head, you don't want to go to work. I said, there's a problem here, and I need to do something that's more creative and more that's going to let me express my creativity more. And that's how I started to do this film and really concentrate on doing this feature film.
Can you point to a specific moment where you said to yourself, I know I don't have any money right now, but I'm going to make a movie anyways?
Oh, wow. There were points throughout that whole five-year period that I was like that. I mean, I didn't have any money to start off with. I actually started off with a grant from the Brooklyn Arts Council for $150. And I would tell people, oh, I'm going to make a feature film. And they said, $150? How are you ever going to do a monumental task like making a feature film? But I knew that if you just kept on, and pursuing what you want to do, it would happen. And also, I was just very frustrated with the images of women. And I was convinced that this film had an audience, and no one was going to tell me any differently.
How did you get the rest of the money to make your film?
Well, a lot of it was in-kind services. You know, my family came in and helped. Also, I actually started in approaching investors in the film. The filmmaker Michael Moore, who directed the film Roger and Me, I met him through the Black Filmmakers Foundation, and I kept on calling him and calling him, and I knew that he was there. He wanted to help young filmmakers. He put in some money to help out. Terry McMillan, the author of Waiting to Exhale and Disappearing Acts, who I did not know at all. I just sent a script to her, and she lives on the West Coast, and she called me up and said, I'm at the last couple of pages of the script, and I'm all, like, riveted about Chantel and Tyrone and what's going to happen. And she said, whatever I can do to help you, what little I can do. And people like that, Nelson George pitched in to help. I work with a producer who produced Just Another Girl in IRT along with me, Irwin Wilson, who worked nonstop, and we worked 24 hours a day sometimes to get this film done. The cast and crew worked deferred payment. They didn't get paid. We said if we sold the film and if it got distributed, then they would get paid. So they're happy now. So there are a lot of creative ways to get a film done without having the money up front.
We were talking about how Chantel has attitude and mm-hmm. how she could talk her way through any situation. It seems to me that's what you need to be a starting filmmaker. You probably had to talk your way through all kinds of situations.
Oh, yes, we did, definitely. One day we were actually filming. The film was shot in 17 days, and so that's a tight schedule for a feature film. And we had actually started one morning at 4 a.m., and I wanted to shoot the scene on the Brooklyn Bridge where the skyline is when Chantel tells Tyrone that she's pregnant. And when we got over there, it was pitch dark. I mean, we couldn't see our camera cases. We were tripping all over each other. We had just a couple of sun guns, lights that were really small that really didn't emit that much light. And you have to have a lot of light to shoot in an environment like that when it's so dark. And there was a actually someone was doing a big budget commercial in the same area that we were. And, you know, I went over to him and they were laughing at us. They said, "What are you doing, a feature film?" So they actually pointed their huge HMI light towards us so we could get the shot off. And so we did have a lot of situations where we didn't think we could even get this film done. But you have to be creative. You have to think on your feet. When a location falls through, you have to be ready to go to another one. You have to be ready to say, this is going to work.
Can you think of another time when being able to talk somebody into helping you really paid off?
Well, like with Nelson George, who also put in, he's an investor, and he put in some money in the film. He lives in my neighborhood in Fort Greene in Brooklyn, and I would walk down DeKalb Avenue, and I would see him every day, and he didn't know me from Adam. And I would follow him around saying, "Please read my script." And he would like, no, you know, "I don't know you." And he got so tired of that, I guess just my perseverance. He just said, okay, let me read it. And he read it, called me up as soon as he finished it and said, you know, "What can I do to help?" So there were a lot of people who really pitched in to help us in those dark hours. I actually edited the film in my apartment, in my kitchen. I had little pieces of film all around. I would have little pieces of film in my jelly sandwich. I would have to wipe it off and stick it back in with the splicing tape. And because I didn't have enough money to hire an editor to really come in and help at first. And I was cutting the film, which was almost a 2-hour cut at first, all by myself. So it was a monumental task. Sometimes I had more film cans in the refrigerator than food. But I decided, hey, I'm going to do this, and no matter what, nothing's going to stop me.
So do you have another film in the works now?
Yes, I am writing something now that's completely different from Just Another Girl on the IRT. And, you know, since we won the special jury prize for Best First Feature at the Sundance Film Festival, I've been getting calls from the West Coast, from some studios and people out there, financing people in Europe, who said that people, some actors whose agents want to work with, who said their clients want to work with me. So, you know, it's a kind of exciting period, but I'm trying to keep my feet on the ground and continue to write, you know, good scripts and work very hard to make a script good for the audience.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Leslie Harris, she wrote and directed the new film Just Another Girl on the IRT. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton says he wants to lift the ban on federal funding of abortion for poor women. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, are you covering that on All Things Considered?
We are. Paz Cohn will have a story about the president's spokesman saying that a request to repeal the Hyde Amendment will be in his budget proposal that's going to Congress. Also today, we'll be hearing from a Republican member of the Senate Armed Services Committee about why he opposes lifting the ban on gays in the military. And Mary Kay Magstad reports on the closing of the last refugee camp in Thailand for Cambodian refugees, and also on the prospects for peace in the homeland to which those Cambodians will be returning.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1990, Roseanne Cash released Interiors, an album largely about the breakup of her marriage to country music singer and producer Rodney Crowell. Interiors was hailed as an artistic breakthrough, but it wasn't a commercial one. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Cash's new collection, The Wheel, is as good as Interiors and deserves a wider audience.
In the middle of my life, when my fate was sealed and tied, heavens rained down fire, the earth and moon conspired to open up my eyes, make me face my lies.
I can't think of anyone's unhappiness I enjoy more than Roseanne Cash's. She makes melancholy, guilt, and despair seem like exquisite pleasures, the morose feelings from which lovely music is made. On the song I just played, Change Partners, Cash reaches the second verse and murmurs, "I crawl through an abyss, I struggle and resist," and the tear in her voice might make you shiver. Set to a jangly, Beatlesque melody, Change Partners says that infidelity is inevitable. And even if you don't believe that, and I assure my wife I don't, Roseanne Cash has created a song whose music is so right, so inevitable itself, that it's impossible not to go along with her perfect pessimism, which pervades every song.
I'm staying in your house. I'm sleeping in your bed. I'm walking through your dreams. I'm dancing through your head. I'm calling from the streets. I'm crying like the wind. 'Cause you are there and I am here. And you won't let me in.
If you break down the elements that comprise this new album, the wheel probably shouldn't be as good as it is. In the hands of most other musicians, the extravagant agony of broken romance can be insufferable. In fact, Cash is trafficking in the sort of damp self-pity that I can't abide in mopey, idolized performers ranging from Sting to Morrissey. And then there's the imagery that Cash uses to make her points. It's the blatant stuff of Jungian therapy, portentous references to primal shapes and phenomena, fire, water, air, earth, the moon invoked as a symbol of feminine wisdom and fate. The album is named for that profound banality, The Wheel, as representing the cycle of life.
How long was I asleep? When did we plan to meet? Have you been waiting long for me? When did the sky turn black? Do you still want me back? I'll pick it all up piece by piece. And the wheel.
Roseanne Cash believes in all this stuff so deeply that she invests her exhausted cymbals with a gleaming vividness. Like all first-rate pop artists, she takes familiar, even cliched materials and creates variations that make everything seem new. I'm sorry that Roseanne Cash seems so unhappy so much of the time, but I'm also sure that she understands why it makes her listeners feel so good.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
I walk through the wind, the snow and the rain, and no one is there when I fall. Sound of my heartbeat is all I have left me, but you know once I had it all. If there's a God on my side, why don't she show me her face? If there's a God on my side, could she live in this place? There's a God on my side, she inside these walls. There's a God on my side, she not hear me call.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Kim Rich grew up in Alaska around pimps, con men, gamblers, and prostitutes. Her father was one of the most notorious underworld figures in Anchorage during that city's boom years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Kim Rich about her new memoir, Johnny's Girl. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.